Do, 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 do. This podcast was recorded by Dr. Volz on Monday the 19th at Dorkbot.
Okay, first of all, thanks to our host for having us. Encounter Space. Yeah, I was going to say that next. There's a donation jar where? By the bar? So please donate generously for to support the Encounter having us here. Thanks to Karen for organizing, as always. No, don't say that until the end. Thanks to Pete the bartender. Thanks to all of you for being here. And anybody else I need to thank?
The who?
We'll thank them when they get here. Okay, so first up is Greg Lay. A man who needs no introduction. Okay, so first up, before Greg actually starts speaking, will be the video. So without further ado, let's go to the video.
Humans are filled with electricity. When you have a cut, the cut will heal because of electrical bonding that goes on in the skin. Electricity is very much a part of us.
Lightning's been around as long as humans have. Just this wonderful thing coming down from the skies. It's caused humans to give lightning a mystical quality. And so even when it's produced artificially with a machine like this, it still touches that sort of reptilian brain center in a way that's undeniable.
It's just sort of a magical act to see something like lightning brought to heal and sort of projected in a controlled way for entertainment. There's something alive about the arcs from Tesla coils.
It's a staple of every mad scientist laboratory. This is the biggest one. It's the biggest mad scientist, perhaps.
Try to use things from nature and integrate them into the art. Nature to me is the best.
Out of the blue, I was approached by an artist who builds these large kinetic sculptures down in Los Angeles, and he asked me if it was possible to build a device that would produce 50-foot lightning bolts out into the air.
I wanted to use an absolutely simple form that allowed for the most voltage and the most lightning to come out of it.
So once I realized that the artist was actually serious about building this device, I decided, well, this is worth quitting my job and spending a year of my life, and I went for it.
I'm an artist and been an artist since I was 25. I'm 58 now.
I'm an electrical engineer by trade, and my specialty is power transmission and conversion. This is primarily a sculpture, but at the heart of the sculpture is what's known as a Tesla coil. A Tesla coil is a resonant transformer that can develop millions and millions of volts. And the end product is a display of lightning that comes out of the top.
The Tesla coil is named after its inventor, Nikola Tesla, who's a Serbian born at the end of last century.
One of the reasons he developed the Tesla coil was to provide energy to people all around the world. He believed that there was a way to put energy into the atmosphere such that people around the world could receive the energy, pull it off, and power their homes and their businesses.
The Tesla coil broadcasts power. Here I have an element from a neon sign. You can see how brightly it's glowing. That's because of the radiated energy from the Tesla coil is actually energizing the light bulb. What Tesla has discovered is that any coil of wire exhibits a frequency at which it rings. Given that a secondary coil exhibits a natural ringing frequency, the challenge to a Tesla coil designer is to build a primary circuit that plays the same note and thereby energizes the electricity in the secondary coil.
A lot of my experience with Tesla coils has come from changing them and perfecting them for SRL shows.
Survivor Research Labs is an organization, and what we do is we basically stage shows with machines and robots and various other kinds of technical artifacts. The big Tesla coil just sort of provides sort of a backdrop for the most part against which the other machines can work out their various violent ends or issues.
When I saw Greg in context with the group that he works with, I realized that this is the person, because he had already worked with kind of an artistic framework. He had no limitations, so to speak, on what's right, you know, what's safe, how far you can go.
After every show, I realized, if I did this, it would make it a little bit better, or make it last longer, or put out a little bit more voltage.
I just think he has a real feeling for that sort of maxim of physicists, which is one should always be trying to release the greatest amount of energy in the shortest period of time. And I think that he really believes that, and down to the core of his being. And I think that drives him to build things bigger and better and more extreme.
The electrum is a really good challenge to bring science and art together. The artist working on this has a really good handle on the aesthetic, but knows very little about high voltage. And I've had to give him a few basic rules about high voltage.
The first day when I was talking with Greg, and I said, Greg, I'd like to do a stone tower, and just a stone tower. Like dry laid stone, so it's just like stone goes up and out of the top of the tower comes the lightning. And of course he shot that down like bam. Then there were a series of concept drawings that I did. I like to like background the technology and see just the result of what it gives.
I nixed these because electrically you can't have these corners out here. It's also an interesting challenge to try to wedge a practical high voltage device into something that's just purely aesthetic. I sent these examples to him of how it might work. But he looked at these and said, oh, these are way too phallic.
And then eventually we came up with the one that was the simplest, as it turns out, which was based on the letter I.
The project right now involves two teams. One in New Zealand and one here in San Francisco. New Zealand is the place where it's going to go. And right now they're all busy installing an earthing array. They have to install a substation. Power New Zealand is involved with that. They're bringing in some 11,000 volt feeders for this device, which needs 130,000 watts, or about the equivalent of 1,200 televisions. The San Francisco team consists of a welder, Chip Flynn, a master machinist over in Oakland, Tim Wadlington, who's building the rotary gap system, and then about three or four other people that I'm subcontracting out sections of the job.
Yeah, once you've seen those 6-foot lightning bolts, it's just not as satisfying anymore, is it? You got to have the 14-foot one. And then the next thing you know, you got to have a 30-foot lightning bolt. You know what I mean? It's just like owning a boat.
Yeah, or a motorcycle.
Yeah.
Let's get it on!
I had to mow my lawn, my aunt's lawn, my grandma's lawn, my grandma and grandpa, Flynn and Guest's lawn. I had to mow lots of lawns. I was always doing something when I was a kid. Now I always do stuff now that I'm adult, and I'm always busy and rushing around doing shows and helping build, you know, Tesla coils. People Haters, a group that does robotic performances. What People Haters good for is learning stuff. Doing performances like makes us all build new machines. As I build more things, I get better. I got involved with the Tesla Coil Project and Greg because that's how I make my living. That's how I do the People Hater thing. That's how I pay my rent. That's how I buy food. I fabricate and build machine or do electronics or fix forklifts sometimes.
You want a hammer too?
Yes. Give me my Captain Caveman hammer next to the ladder. Next to the ladder, I want the Caveman hammer.
This sphere has to withstand being outdoors for 20 years. So the material I chose to build it was a 304 alloy, stainless steel. There's 30 rings, 15 different sizes. The whole sphere weighs about 1,000 pounds. Before we ship it off to New Zealand and it's gone forever, I want to get up into the sphere and make some measurements of the fine current structures in the base of the streamers.
We're at about 37 feet off the ground. Just short of four stories. There's my house way over there in Brisbane.
Waiting for the view when it's at 2 million volts.
If you have a machine that produces an electric field in surrounding air that's higher than the air can withstand, it'll start ripping electrons off the atoms, and as they recombine and fall back into lower energy state, they produce light.
That surge you just saw there was about 50,000 volts for a very, very short period, whereas electrum can keep it up continuous. The electrum sculpture will use a Tesla coil that is the largest Tesla coil ever built. This is inside the base of the coil. This box contains all of the high-power switch gear, and it feeds this set of transformers right here. These step to 400-volt three-phase up to 10,000 volts. Then there's a stack of 60,000-volt rectifiers, and they produce 22,000 volts. This 22,000-volt DC goes through these conduits and down to this device, which is called a charging reactor. And finally, the 44,000 volts ends up on this capacitor bank here. This switch here, which is called a rotary gap, will connect that capacitor bank to the primary drive coil up in the tower. And the magnetic field generated by that drive coil excites the secondary winding, which is a mile and a half of 10-gauge wire. And it's that secondary winding that generates the 3 million volts.
I still haven't seen it work. I want to go see it work.
Before we ship it off to the farm in New Zealand, first we need to configure it for full power. Eventually ramp it up to full power to make sure nothing's going to explode or catch on fire.
This is the design for the control panel for electrum. Over here on the left is the mains current going into the machine. This button here closes the final interlock. This button here crashes all of the hazardous sources of energy. But this knob here, the lowest setting is about 10,000 watts, and the top setting here is about 130,000 watts. It's pretty close to being shippable. Everything up in the tower, the rotary gap, all the charging circuit.
We're going to take it up one step at a time, and hopefully by the end of the night, we'll have the thing running at 130,000 watts.
Thank you.
That wasn't supposed to happen.
If something bad happens and it starts flaming, mm-hmm. hit this button.
Okay. I can do that.
I gotta go look at the meter while this is on.
Very apprehensive, because at full power you have the greatest risk of something going wrong in a big way. Nothing up there. Usually if something fails up in the tower, it's immediately obvious from looking. After about 45 minutes of all of us looking at it and banging our heads against the wall, we figured it out.
What's wrong with the transformers?
The transformers are specified for Y connection. And they need to be delta. I am cannibalizing my old coil for some diodes.
Oh, that's cool. Spare parts.
This power supply is a martyr to the cause.
Both science and art, there is no end to the speculation, and the paradigms are always switching on you, so what you believe one time can be totally erased and you have to go another direction.
There was an imbalance in the transformers that caused the voltage driving the rest of the coil to be the wrong voltage. Now we'll see what we get. It's been a rough road in developing because there is no precedence to look at, but that's been the way for the last 3 months. That's the heartbreak of development. Tonight is the highest power we've run the coil at about 80,000 watts. We're at two-thirds full power. Everything we do right at this point, we're trying to increase the power level that the coil can run at. Electric field around here is enough to raise the audience several hundred volts. But since everybody rises by the same voltage, nobody notices.
I am from Baraboo, Wisconsin. Been associated with Greg due to the internet Tesla list. Read about his project here in San Francisco and decided to come out and see it. It's one of the largest operating public Tesla coils in the world.
My husband came Wednesday evening and insisted that we come this evening.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So we had to come.
Let me reiterate a few important points. You got a lot of people here tonight, a lot more than I imagined. At this angle right here between my arms is where shrapnel goes in case the rotary gap explodes. The edges are spinning at about 300 miles an hour. So if you could, just clear to either side of my arm.
I saw the most fantastic thing I've ever seen in my life. In my 63 years of living, I've never seen anything like this, and I probably will never see anything like this again.
I wonder what that looks like from an airplane. I was just dying to find out.
Me too. I was thinking the same thing.
I thought two airplanes coming over, and this thing was just going da-da-da-da-da.
looked like they were going about as much as 40 feet away from the large sphere. And you can hear the air collapsing around the, when they discharge. Interesting how they find a place to go, and occasionally it finds ground and the light fixture, and everybody kind of wakes up because it's louder and bigger sparks.
So when you're in the presence of lightning, it's like being in the presence of a primary source of energy. It's something we'd hardly ever get to be around. So the memory of it is a body memory besides just a brain memory. Your body really gets excited, your heart beats faster, and you actually remember the situation in the lightning.
You witness something like that in nature, and it's so quick. But here, it's like you actually have time to like really take it in and be like, yeah.
It's an amazing thing to see so much electricity and power discharged in the way that a Tesla coil does. It's a really beautiful thing.
Part of what I do is expressing myself, but I like the idea that there is an audience there and that they understand what I'm doing.
We're going to do a graphic demonstration of Faraday's Law. We call this Project Canadian Bacon.
First person who really, really wanted to go up there was Jonathan. He's from Canada. He's just going to be inside while it's on to demonstrate that, in fact, all voltage is on the outside of the sphere, not on the inside. It can be dangerous. It's like driving a car on the freeway can be dangerous if you don't do it right. I personally hate to get electrocuted.
It demonstrates Faraday's Law. If you're inside, you're at the same potential. There's supposed to be no field inside of a conductor. So as long as you don't stick your hand through the wire mesh, you should be safe.
Inside the cage, there's no electric field there, so there's no difference between you and the inside of the cage. You both might be at 3 million volts, but as long as you're at the same voltage, you're okay. The only way you can get electrocuted is if you try to reach outside the cage, where the arcs are, and the arcs that are a very different voltage.
I sat on the top of what I believe is the world's largest Tesla coil right now, as it was operating at between 2 and 3 million volts potential.
He's like, are you sure you don't feel anything? Come on, go grab the rim. He must feel like, no, I feel a cold piece of metal.
That's neat.
Nothing at all.
Yeah.
No, this whole Faraday cage thing really does work.
Greg had mentioned that it's a Faraday cage, which essentially cuts off the electromagnetic spectrum. In fact, he wanted to do some scientific samplings for a paper that he's generating out of the beginnings of lightning.
Because of the size of the electrode on electrum, you're able to take a very close look at the inner workings of the arc and what happens in the arc as it grows out.
When it went off, it was just, there was this total relief that I wasn't getting electrocuted. Logically, I knew I wouldn't get electrocuted, but you just never know until the switch is thrown. The arc starts right about a foot from your face and travels off, and it's hard to tell how far it's going, but you can tell it's going a ways.
So Greg went up in it, and I felt that since he lived through that experience, I would go up in it and kind of correct a photograph that has gone around with Tesla. Tesla's sitting in a room. He's reading a book in this room. The room is filled with lightning. It was a double exposed shot. He wasn't really in that room. My first thought was, when this lightning goes off, am I going to jump? Because if you reach out, you're dead. You grab those pipes out there, just kiss life away.
Our next act, we're going to burn an artist.
There was a moment where I realized I'm going to be alive or dead, and there's really no in-between. So I just might as well relax and read the book, which is my job up here, and just get rid of all these frightening thoughts. And there's that plastic. So I got the chair on plastic, and the floor is vibrating. And I'm thinking, if this son of a bitch goes, I got to figure out how to grab without going through that. That's all I thought about that, got that worked out, then I emptied my mind. It was all right.
Right now it's sad. The arcs are about 3/5 normal because of the power restriction. But in New Zealand, it'll be a lot happier. A wealthy and rather active patron of the arts in New Zealand commissioned Eric to build a lightning sculpture for his farm.
He's got a farm, which is essentially a large farm with the sculpture part added to it. He's been bringing in artists from all over the world. I mean, there's Jim Terrell and Richard Serra and Saul LeWitt, myself, and others will be coming.
And so on a regular basis, they need to go through and set all the gaps in the rotary system and check for mice and birds and things that might nest on insulators. I'll probably have to go out there once a year just to look things over and make sure things still in spec.
Electrum is downslope from the balcony of the house. Look this way towards the work, and out here is this beautiful bay. It's sited in a magnificent area. So it's about 50 feet away from the house, which is interesting. Okay, it's 50 feet away from the house, so that when you look at it, you're looking straight at the light. It's that awesomeness that you get from witnessing a primary force of nature. And it's just that awesomeness. I think that it was one of the primary things that I was intending, just to get that sense of the awesome in your life.
Electrum was certainly a unique experience. It was an important stepping stone where I learned how to scale up some of these high voltage problems. Ultimately, it was a very essential stepping stone towards building the advanced lighting facility. This is a 3D conceptual design for the advanced lighting facility. The advanced lighting facility is essentially the largest Tesla coil that's possible to build. This whole facility will use about 5 million watts. The purpose of the lightning facility is multifaceted. I'm interested in the scientific aspects to study how lightning propagates. It would be a facility for testing aircraft. And also I'd like to construct it just as an educational facility to remind people of the kind of technology that used to be cutting edge before the advent of computers, and just to leave something behind so we don't forget that kind of stuff and disappear into the internet. It consists of two towers about 120 feet tall, generate a field full of lightning that's about the size of a football field, 10 stories off the ground. We're ready to start the initial phase tomorrow. If we can just find somebody who's rich enough and crazy enough to finance the project.
now Greg will go on with the rest of his talk.
That guy was quite a hippie, wasn't he? I'll never get used to myself on the screen, I don't think, ever. It's interesting that this month, it's 10 years to the month from the time that the Electrum Project was initiated. It's hard to imagine 1997 was 10 years ago, huh? Let me see if I can't switch the monitor over. Okay. First off, I'd like to thank Alberta Chu for making this documentary, without which it would be almost impossible for me to prove that Electrum even existed. At the time, I didn't have a good camera, let alone a video camera. I'd also like to thank the myriad of people that brought all of their mechanical and electrical expertise to the Electrum Project, some of which are probably here tonight, if I could see them all.
Space brother.
Oh, there's one over there, Paul Butterfield. So I would like to discuss why we would want to expand the scale of a machine like this way past the scale of Electrum and explore what's called in physics the megascale, essentially where you're dealing with tens of millions of volts. There's a number. Can people hear me, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a number of compelling reasons. Some of them have emerged within the last couple of years, actually. Others have been around since the 60s. There are certain large machines, particularly in Russia, that have experienced anomalous events. By this, I mean they generate arcs that are way beyond what you would predict through classical mechanics and physics. One of these, a machine that's even larger that does this on a daily basis is lightning. Lightning is somehow able to launch lightning bolts from the cloud to ground using a 50th to 100th of the voltage that you would predict from laboratory measurements. And there's also a feature which I call the classical size limit. Places a fundamental limit on how large you could build a practical Tesla coil that produces arcs. And I feel very strongly that since there is such a limit, that science should have at least one machine that operates there in case there is unusual physics. This is a photo that came out of Siberia. Some experiments they were doing in the late 60s. Of course, that was at the height of the Cold War, and people in the West weren't able to see these photos for some time. Siberian Institute for Power Engineering was very interested in developing a multi-megavolt transmission line to pipe hydroelectric power 696 kilometers across Russia. And the long distance requires a high voltage, of course. So they built these prototype transmission lines and tested them with this device on the left here.
I'll just point at it.
This is a 92-foot high Marx generator that produces 5 megavolts. And you can see it's got a case that I think is made out of plastic or transite or some such, then has these equipotential rings to equalize the electric field that's up the side. And normally, something that generates 5 megavolts might arc about 5 meters or so. Certainly, they designed it to where it can't arc to the ground up there. And if you placed a grounded object maybe as close as here, you might expect it to finally arc. However, they discovered that if they played around with the rise times, they were able to get it to produce these tremendous arcs that went hundreds of meters.
And they offered no explanation for this. And for decades, people in the West heard about this, but kind of shrugged it off as like another Tunguska explosion type story. But fairly recently, engineers from the West have been able to go over there and witness events like this. And there's still not a really good explanation of how they can do this. They're actually able to reach arcs out into the parking lot where the cars were and hit cars. Another good reason to explore electrical machines in the megascale is a relatively new theory called relativistic runaway breakdown. It was proposed by two Russian physicists, and it's an interesting new theory on how lightning can operate with such low voltage. And essentially, the theory postulates that cosmic rays, which can produce secondary showers of electrons, can produce enough relativistic electrons such that when they enter the cloud and the electric fields in the cloud, they can start to accelerate, and because they are relativistic, they contract in size, which reduces their friction with normal air. They slip between the air molecules easier and can accelerate to higher energies and release more relativistic electrons. And if this happens over a long enough distance, you can actually initiate a chain reaction of these high-energy electrons. One interesting number here that falls out of the math of this theory is this 50-meter characteristic length. That is the minimum length that you need between your electrodes in order to even see this event, which largely explains why nobody has ever seen it before and why lightning is such a mystery. Back in 2005, Smith and his colleagues compiled some data from the RISI satellite, which had gamma ray detectors on board that could focus and look at the Earth. And they correlated gamma ray flashes with thunderstorm activity on the Earth. The white X's are gamma ray flashes, which are predicted by the relativistic runaway breakdown theory to occur whenever you have one of these runaway breakdown reactions. And as you can see, there's a fairly decent correlation between the two. If lightning was purely classical physics, you would expect to see no gamma ray flashes or a random distribution of flashes. So given that we're interested in a machine that can definitely explore relativistic runaway breakdown, where do you set the design parameters? This chart here expresses essentially the cost of generating a given arc length. Down on the x-axis, we have arc length in feet. The y-axis is the power required in thousands of kilowatts. And the blue dashed line is a standard well-known relation of power versus arc length. That relation was determined empirically primarily by a large number of Tesla coils. All the Tesla coils in the world exist down here on the curve. So this is a bit of an extrapolation, but it's a very smooth, well-known curve down here. Back in the 90s, when I was working with some simulation software at Stanford, I plugged a Tesla coil into it just because it was a well-known quantity, and of course, the next natural unavoidable thing you do with a simulator is figure out how big you can build a coil. And up about here is when I ran into the issue that the ion lifetimes limit how low the frequency can get. And of course, the frequency drops as the coil gets bigger, just like a pipe organ pipe. And if the frequency goes down so far, then the ions have time to extinguish between pulses. Hence the red line, which indicates an increase in power demand as you go larger. Also on this the same chart, you can see kind of a graduated background that goes from white to blue. And that represents the probability of being able to see relativistic runaway breakdown events. This line here represents 50 meters at 164 feet. So if you're operating here, you're very unlikely to see any relativistic events. Whereas, according to the authors of the theory, if you're about twice this, then you're very likely to see them. So we're kind of between a rock and a hard place. We definitely want to be above this line, but we don't want to start climbing the steep wall of that red curve. So the proposed operating point is going to be right here, where we can have about a 250-foot gap between the electrodes and operate at about 12 megawatts. Down here in this corner, for reference, I have the Electrum coil on the curve and the SRL coil, which I call the 120L50K.
Why do you call it that?
It's a 120-inch secondary that runs at 50 kilowatts. The Electrum's actually the 180L120K. This is the SRL coil, photo by Scott Beal. This was last July, was it? And this coil has a typical strike range of about 26 feet at 25 kilowatts. Electrum has a typical striking range of 48 feet at 130 kilowatts. I've had, over the years, several people that were semi-serious about building this project, but they all wanted to build it somewhere in here because that would be cheaper, of course. But pretty much useless, since we really do want to get well past this line into interesting territory. Nobody else seems to that was willing to pay for it seemed to share my enthusiasm, though. I'm no longer the best qualified person to answer that. Lately, we've been able to attract some real people to work on this project and to develop a funding strategy and business models and an approach how to actually get this thing funded and built. And so I'm no longer going to guess for them. Also, the number's still in a bit of stasis as we're trying to get estimates from. Pardon?
Do you want me to answer that question?
Yes.
The capital project from design to build, take it off the ground, and to turn the key on and be able to actually do science is going to be approximately $31 million. It's not an insignificant.
This is what the machine would look like operating at the 250-foot, 12-megawatt point. It's essentially two towers, 12 stories high. A lot has changed since this VRML model was built. There is no longer a switchgear house. Back in the late 90s, the only way to switch this type of power was with a huge arrays 50 feet long of water-cooled tungsten gaps with a supersonic airflow across them. Since then, technology in IGBT and silicon has marched forward, and now a solid-state solution is clearly the way to go. I guess there's a silver lining to having waited all this time. These are some of the specs of the proposed project. The total arc strike distance is 250 to 300 feet, depending on how straight the arc is. The total processed power is just over 12 megawatts. The peak output voltage between the towers is 11.3 million volts, which allows us to maintain the minimum critical field to produce a relativistic breakdown. This is a detail of one of the tower elevations. It's 121 feet to the top of the toroid. The drive structure goes in here below this lowest equipotential ring. It runs at about, it circulates 40,000 volts at 50,000 amps. The secondary coil, which is coupled to that drive coil, consists of 10.5 miles of 4-aught aluminum cable. There are equipotential strike rings all the way up to coil to protect it from arcs that occasionally will curl back and hit the center. And those would produce, at this power level, very nasty burns on the coil. And there's a central elevator shaft to bring people and equipment up to the top. And in the top electrode, there will be experimental stations, and that's where the actual control console for the machine will be, since it has the best view of what's going on. I think in the later part of the operating plan, once the thing is actually running and off the ground, that some kind of visitor area would go up there. With Canadian bacon, yeah. Well, moving on to more practical research opportunities. There are several bits of industrial research you could do with a machine like this. At the present time, there are no ways to fully test a full-scale aircraft or vehicle. You could also test certain building structures, block houses, radio houses, protection devices for buildings. I think one of the more important ones that might emerge from the relativistic studies is to develop techniques to redirect lightning away from power plants and populated areas. And, of course, one of the more physics-related research opportunities is to try to reproduce some of the plasmoids and ball lightning that make up so many anecdotes all around the world. Tesla complained about fireballs with his big coil in Colorado. He considered them a nuisance, and he wanted to find out what their origins were just to prevent them from happening. And then he never went back and pursued that. One of the interesting things about the ball lightning, at least from anecdotes, is how long it lasts. There are reports of ball lightning lasting 20 seconds. And to try to imagine a mechanism that contains 6,000 degree plasma freely in air for 10 seconds is undescribable. There's many theories, none of them have been proven. One of the interesting industrial aspects would be to study survivability, both for people and equipment. There's some interesting statistics from the National Weather Service about lightning. 300 people are struck by every year. Men are killed 4.6 times as often as women. The National Weather Service offered no explanation for that. About 30% of all power outages are lightning-related. The picture on the left is kind of a classic picture. According to the National Weather Service, these two brothers and the photographer were in an intense electric storm. And as you can see, their hair is charged up, and the static forces are pushing their hair apart. And then the description dryly reads, "Shortly after this photograph was taken, both brothers and the photographer were killed." But fortunately, the film wasn't overexposed. On the left is a picture of an unfortunate plane taken off out of Japan. And on the left is a test facility representing how they test aircraft nowadays. They build scale models because they only have small electrical machines. And tests like that largely tell you that the pointy parts of a plane take the hit. Of course, the scale model doesn't have all of the hydraulics, wiring, gas tanks, engines, and such. It kept on. Usually only once every year or 2 years does lightning down a plane. That's the return stroke is generating so much light that it washed out the camera. It's also a beautiful image of the leader stroke, which started at the ground and went up, and the return stroke coming back down from the cloud.
Why doesn't PG&E and Cisco have those lightning lamps in the power to multi-billion-dollar industry, spend the $35 million to try and build larger and larger lightning lamps like the one you want to build? Is that running them from making a jump?
Well, nobody is... Also in industry, there's not many people that build such things anymore. I think they're all in Russia, and half of them are dead.
So which one are you?
I'm just an enthusiast. Okay. I thought I'd throw in here some ideas for public performances. I'm sure there's many more and many greater ideas, but these are all things that could be done with a machine like this.
I heard that Ben Franklin never really did the kite experiment.
Well, it's easy enough to find out. Just get somebody dressed as Ben Franklin and give them a kite, and we'll try it. Surprisingly low. Several one-hour shows for a day will probably represent about $1,200 of energy. I suppose you could, but you can do a bunch of stuff as an amusement park. Most pacemaker paranoia stems from the very early ones that were sensitive to magnetic fields. But since the early 80s, pacemakers don't have those kind of susceptibilities. They still put the warning signs everywhere, just because who would dare not put the warning sign up? I mean, there's people that think there's still a danger of kids getting apples with razor blades at Halloween, even though there's never been a single instance of that. I guess my favorite one of this whole list is the last one, where while the thing is on at full power, you could safely fly a helicopter through the streamer flux. I think that would be an interesting ride. There's several interesting design challenges on this project. The first one is structural. On the left is Tesla's Wardenclyffe Tower from 1903. And this was carefully designed out of great big wood timbers, such that if any one timber caught on fire, the thing wouldn't collapse. Nowadays, of course, we have things that I'm sure Tesla would die for, such as pultruded fiberglass structural shapes on the right. Both of those structures are completely made of fiberglass, and they have very good electrical properties, in addition to being non-flammable. He never was able to energize it. J.P. Morgan pulled the funding before he was finished.
I read somewhere that he had it on for one night or something.
I've never seen any photos. I think there was some deal where he set test pulses into it and it was throwing little bits off the top.
What happened to the tower?
The tower shown here on the left was eventually destroyed in 1915 because the Navy was afraid it would be used as a navigational tool for German boats. It was out on Long Island. Another design challenge is electrical, in particular the primary drive system. Each tower will need about 2,000 megawatts of peak impulse power every time it fires. A drive system like this will require what will essentially be the world's largest solid-state switch, 40,000 volts, 50,000 amperes. On the right is a solid-state switch on an electric train that runs at 3,300 volts, 1,200 amps.
Is that the biggest solid-state switch currently available?
No, they have 6,500 volt now. That was just an easy photo to get, but it's about the same size. And, of course, there's Electrum's rotary gap, which is 44,000 volt, 2,800 amps. But the rotary gap for Electrum handles the current for only a tenth of the time that the Lightning Lab has to. Another issue that has become a true design challenge is where to get the power. A lot of the sites we're looking at are rather remote, necessarily. And the original idea was to approach Nevada Power, and they were enthusiastic about it. However, once it got up to 12 megawatts, they lost their enthusiasm because if you suddenly turn on and off 12-megawatt loads, the power grid in the nearby county area goes all over the place. And they have ways of fixing that, but they're so incredibly expensive, and the penalties are so huge for having peak loads like that it's actually much cheaper to spin your own power. And the way we would do that here is have six of these 16-cylinder diesel plants.
So it'd be off the grid?
Yes.
You run it with biodiesel easily?
I have heard of a biodiesel conversion for these. However, this is a very expensive machine, and you don't want to screw around with the fuel. Besides, the whole area would smell like French fries. Which isn't a bad thing, but here's our development plan for the construction. It consists of two phases. The first phase, which will take about 2 years, consists of mostly system design, more thinking than hardware. And this is going to occur largely in San Francisco. We're working on getting some warehouse space over here on the other side of Potrero Hill, and where we'll begin experimental measurements to confirm some of the ideas we're using to freeze the design parameters. Then we'll launch into the detailed component design, namely of the drive system, the high current switches, the capacitor banks, protection systems and such, the control system as well. The control system for this is non-trivial. And all during this, of course, we'll be working very hard on trying to secure the funding for the Phase 2 capital project construction. In the Phase 2, that's when Earth starts moving out at the site in Nevada. The main architectural and engineering effort to design the foundations, visitor center, all of these other things that make it a real thing. The civil engineering work will be done. There will have to be some drilling into rock. followed by the installation of the main fiberglass pultrusion towers, and then finally the capital equipment, the big power devices, and testing of the completed system.
What kind of ground do you have to have?
That's a good question. What kind of earth ground? The earth ground will be very extensive since it's a very dry environment. It's a matrix of troughs that are dug. They extend into about a 1,000-foot circle with radials and then cross radials. And inside each trench, there's going to be a 4-inch perforated iron pipe packed with bentonite clay. And that system will have to be occasionally pressurized with water, especially before each show.
Keep being the player.
The playa has its own set of problems. Okay, so, and the phase two aspect will probably take 2.5 to 3 years. There's some overlap, so if we get funding straight up, the whole thing will probably take about 4 years. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some military application, but we're set up as a nonprofit organization, and I'm not about to go through the paperwork to do classified work. I don't have an objection to classified work, especially if it's interesting, but it's too much of a headache, and I've worked in places where they did classified, it wasn't even classified, they did work that became classified because it was interesting. And then trucks showed up and took all the stuff away. That wasn't very fun. I would consider that a last resort for funding, probably below casinos. Well, as John pointed out to me recently, there's so many incredible opportunities for funding out there that I had no idea. So we have the site selection narrowed down to 6 sites. 5 of them are in Clark County, 1 in Nye County. They're all in southern Nevada, where you can still find some fairly isolated parcels at low cost. Very low humidity, no problems with snow loading, and reasonable access to materials and services. One of my favorite sites that I have at the top of the list is shown there on the right, and I put it up here along with Michael Siebelek's Vermal model because I think it has kind of an uncanny resemblance all the way down to the body of water in the background. Note that the Vermal model was made in almost 10 years ago. So that's the end of my talk here. Electrum was very fortunate to have attracted the talent that it did, and it actually worked much better than I thought. I was able to pull from a lot of people around SRL and such. I'm hoping that the Lightning Lab project will have the same kind of success there, and there's good reason to hope for that now. It's already attracted, and it's, you know, wretched, unfunded state, a couple of people that are really quite remarkable in their talents. One is Susan Joyce, which I think a lot of people here know. She has a gallery down in Los Angeles, and she brings to this project her vast organizational skills and her abilities to negotiate with government agencies, and also her extensive knowledge of the art and media worlds. The other person that's joined, who's already spoken tonight, is John Flynn here, who is a business consultant to a wide variety of industries and has an awesome grasp for how to organize projects like this in a strategic way and go after funding to make them real. So I'm starting to think there's a real threat that this will actually come to life at some point here down the road. That's all I have. Do we have time for questions, or do you want to?
Okay, let's take, I don't know, 5 minutes or so for questions.
Okay.
5-10 minutes.
What has happened to Eric Orr? In 1998, about 6 months after Electrum was completed, he died of a heart attack down in Los Angeles in his studio. I think it has more with the way that he enjoyed life. And since then, all of the artists in Los Angeles that he's friends with, they've had all kinds of benefits, and they've built sculptures in his honor down there. He was a great guy. He was a wonderful guy to know. I wish he was still alive to give me some feedback on this. Is the system still running in Electrum?
When was the last time you were back there, Greg? Every
year. Well, that was my hope. I haven't been back there since I installed it. They have an incredible technical crew there, because on that same farm where it was installed, the owner has an impressive collection of military vehicles. And he requires all of them to operate all of the time. And the people there are just generally smart, and they've completely figured out how to service the thing and keep it running. And they turn it on once a month, run it for a few minutes, just to make sure it's still running.
Is that all they do? Just once a month?
Well, unless the owner is visiting, then they...
Have you any idea how often the owner runs it?
I don't know. I don't think any human was lucky enough to cause the Tunguska explosion. That's just way too much energy in one place. That had to come from outside.
The Space Brothers know about this.
And by the outside, I don't mean sentient necessarily. I mean rocks from space. I'm not interested necessarily in getting electrodes to travel quickly. That was necessary for Electrum, just so they wouldn't burn up. But the moving electrodes are not a technology we're going to use for this project. This is all solid state.
Wait, before you shut that down. That's okay. Thanks, Greg, for a fascinating talk. I wanted you all to notice the URL at the bottom of that page, LOD.org. If any of you are interested in participating in this project, you'll have to beg him to let you on it. So, okay, we're going to take a 15-minute break. And I didn't bring my watch. Okay, 8:48, let's be back here at 9:05, okay? And try to be settled in your seats by then, and we can get started with the next presentation. Thanks. Go by. Is Mark Powell in the house? Mark Powell, we need your loud voice. Give him a hand, isn't he incredible? I actually took lessons with somebody this week to try to talk as loudly as Mark Powell, and they failed miserably, or I failed miserably. Okay, welcome back to the second half of Dorkbot, and I'd like to introduce...
the cable.
the cable. While the cable is being plugged in, let me introduce Monochrome, or some fraction of Monochrome. Sorry? Monochrome, of course, is the famous art group from Vienna. We saw them, was it last week or 2 weeks ago? Last week was the Tug show, and we have with us now some of the members of Monochrome, and I'll let Johannes talk about what they're going to talk about.
Oops. Yo. Ah, cable. Ah. Okay. Good. Ah. Okay, so many people, all Americans or any Canadians? Oh, okay, so welcome to the second part of DorkBot. We were invited by Karen Marcello, wonderful Karen Marcello, give her a hand, please. To talk about a couple of our projects or maybe talk a little bit about our group. So, Monochrome, we are from Vienna, Austria, although one of our team members is from Germany. Whoa, okay. So, at least, yeah, of course, Anschluss. At least, I mean, we provided the world with Adolf Hitler in Austria, so that's just talking about Germany, you know. Okay. So, yeah, Adolf Hitler, Wilhelm Reich, and Falco. So that's... what? And Freud, of course. But Freud's a fraud and Skinner is no use, you know. Good. Okay, so I thought a long time, because I'm the one who has to present Monochrome all the time, the front man. So I thought about how I could call... a little talk here at DorkBot. I thought, maybe no power for theory and or practice. And I thought, that's maybe not a good title. Maybe there's something rotten in the state of Argentina. That's, of course, but I mean, we're in the United States, they have something to do with that, but maybe another title. Maybe I never promised you a Roswell report. reminds me a little bit about, you know, like the giant Tesla coil somewhere in Nevada. Or possibly entropy in the UK. Any British here? No. Okay. So, not a good title either. Or maybe new German dark wafers, we're going to find you. We certainly will. But maybe Jesus loves you more than you will know. Who? I think... Whoa. But I think the last title is probably the best. It's called We Are Great Together, the Liberal Society and Its Enemies. Good. So, what is Monochrome? I mentioned we are from Vienna, Austria, and we are an art, technology, philosophy collective, and that's how we look like. It took us like 2.5 months to render this image, but we just did it like right in time for DorkBot. So... strange people, actually a good gender balance here, you know, two women, I don't know. Okay. But, we're here. I'm in the picture. Yeah, I'm there. It's not Vermel. It's older than Vermel. They call it Vermel. I never used it, so... But look, it's so beautiful. I want to touch it. Okay, so we are in San Francisco. We are near Silicon Valley. So last week, before going to Yosemite, where I fell from a waterfall and dislocated my shoulder, we visited Google. Okay? And there we saw like a new kind of like emerging market thing that Google is now trying to do. It's the Google butt plug. They should invest. It's just standing on a parking space, but they should probably pump a lot of money into this thing. But if you want to blog it, it's on monochrome.it/google-buttplug. Okay, good. Okay. Good. Okay. But basically, I think that's a good topic to start, because we are planning to do a conference, a show here in September in San Francisco. We're actually looking for sponsors. So maybe you're interested in that. And the show or the conference will be called, it's a working title so far, it's called Ars Electronica. Okay? Ars Electronica should be, or I hope will be, a conference about pornography and technological innovation, and how they intersect, and how they work together. And where is Evelyn Ferlinger of Monochrome? Evelyn Ferlinger! And she'll give you a couple of details about the show, and there's PayPal on our site, and if you want to invest, please do it. Okay, so pornography and technological innovation, a conference, possibly, and here is your microphone.
Thank you. So, this is serious. A call for everything, in fact. According to a study by Simon Smith, more than 800 items were registered with the United States Patent and Trademark Office as sex toys between 1840 and 1997. Among them was a condom with a built-in computer chip that can play music. Is this progress? From the depiction of a vulva in a cave painting to the newest internet porn, technology and sexuality have always been closely linked. No one can predict what the future will bring, but history indicates that sex will continue to play an essential role in technological development. The porno effect accompanies every new technological development. Immediately after producing his famous Bible, Gutenberg used his press to print erotica. Photography was utilized just as quickly. In 1874, the London police discovered 130,000 pornographic photos in the course of one single house search. In 1874, the London police... Oh, sorry, that was the sentence I just read. Next sentence. The introduction of cinematic technology also confirmed the close relationship between pornography and technological innovation. In 1896, a pornographic film was shown publicly for the first time, 2 years after the premiere of the first films of any interest to the general public. Since then, more pornographic films than non-pornographic films have been produced. That in 1977, the first video cassettes to appear on the market featured pornographic content should come as no surprise. The development of the camcorder and the Instamatic camera made it possible for anyone so inclined to produce porn in privacy at home. The fact that the first affordable Polaroid model was named The Swinger seems to indicate that the industry was well aware of this possible use. All of these facts could be relegated to the status of curiosities were it not for the important role that pornography has played in the development of new technologies. New technologies are quick to appeal to pornography consumers, and thus these consumers represent a profitable market segment for the suppliers of new products and services. Without telephone sex, a sector that has been yielding enormous profits since the 1980s, providers would have had no incentive to upgrade the communicational infrastructure. And of course, one should not forget the internet, which is notorious for being flooded with pornography. Porno sites were the first to use technologies like audio and video streaming. They were also a driving force behind the spread of high-speed internet connections and made necessary the development of better data systems. Additionally, porn sites have promoted the development of new cultural technologies like in or formal partnering, outsourcing, upselling, and site tracking. Today, a new technology's success with porn consumers is a dependable indicator of the product's overall market potential. Currently, all factors show that high-tech development like virtual reality owe a great deal of their success to their need for further sexual stimulation. One could cite the example provided by the science fiction concept of a full-body interface designed to produce sexual stimulation. But it isn't science fiction anymore. Is it going too far to assume that research in nanotechnology and genetic engineering will be influenced by our sexual needs? The surgical modification of sexual organs is no longer something very unusual. The question is not whether these technologies alter humanity, but how they do so. So what we plan is an international conference with experts from the fields of science, economics, art and technology, and an exhibition featuring international artists and designers in 2007 or 2008. We're looking for speakers, designers, artists, funding, and a location, probably on the west coast of the US. Please contact us.
We even think of doing it on the 28th, 29th, and 30th of September 2007, concerning the talk before our talk, I'm highly interested in, a testicle coil on a micro scale. But I'm not familiar with such technology so far. Okay, good. So far, enough about Ars Electronica. We're trying to set up a wiki next week and a mailing list if you're interested. But let's go to another topic. We realized that there are many people in San Francisco who have Apple computers. Yes. Okay. So I'll tell you what. I'll sing a song for you, a love song about Apple. Okay. Actually, I don't use an Apple. Is there one single person that Monochrome uses and using an Apple? No? Oh, no. We are so poor. We are so poor. Okay. So, Jacob Applebaum, we both went to the Chaos Communication Congress in December. He told me 3 o'clock in the morning, tomorrow, 10 o'clock, like the same day, 10 o'clock, I'll have a talk about cracking Apple's firewall system. So, I need you and the Monochrome guys for an opening act. So, could you sing a song for me? And I thought, okay, I have a couple of hours, so I don't know anything about Apple, but I surely can manage to write a love song about Apple. So, and now I try to sing it for you. I haven't practiced it in like 1.5 months now. And actually, I have to switch from PowerPoint to Windows Media Player now. And I hope it won't crash. Yes. A love song. Long intro, and I have to get like the starting points. Could you help me? Okay. I have to concentrate, okay? No. Close, no matter how far, couldn't be much more from the heart. Forever trusting who we are. Oh, fuck, I love Apple. Never opened myself this way. Life is ours, we live it our way. All these words I don't just say. It's different, it's Apple. The trust I seek and I find in you. Every day for something new. Open mind for a different view. A corporation called Apple. So close, no matter how far. It couldn't be much more from the heart. Forever trusting who we are. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, Apple. Never care for what they do. Never care for what they know. But I know. Preaching to the converted? Well, yes, but with style. It's to fade out. It worked pretty good. Okay, doke. It seemed that it worked pretty good. Actually, that's one of the many pictures we did for a small project. We called it Brand Marker. We asked people on the street to draw logos of corporations from their minds. And that's one of the Apple tries here. But there are some with stripes, you know, because of the colors. And some people can't remember that it was an Apple. They just write think different. Okay. But you can find it online. Google it. Okay. Good. Okay. So the next project, I think I have to get rid of this one here. The next project I'd like to introduce you to, because it's Dorkbot and we're talking about technology, is Soviet Unterzögersdorf. Okay? Soviet Unterzögersdorf. Okay. Yeah. So in 2001, we had, like, basically, I think you don't know that, but near of Vienna in Austria, there is a tiny little country called Soviet Unterzögersdorf. It's just like a couple of square miles, like in size, and it's the last existing republic of the USSR, okay? And in 2001, we, from Monochrome, we organized a vacation in Soviet Unterzögersdorf. So we chartered a big bus and drove people to Soviet Unterzögersdorf. And it was a tiny, tiny village decorated with big, beautiful flags, border control, of course, and many people walking around in Soviet uniforms. One of the guys in Soviet uniforms looked a little bit like myself, and there was one officer looking like Evelyn Furlinger, but similarities, okay? So why did we do that? Okay, there's a long history, like, World War II, you know, and after World War II, Austria was divided by the Allied forces between the British and the French and the Americans and the Soviets. And the Austrians, especially the conservative Austrians, have a big problem, especially with the Soviets. Of course, like after World War II and years of Nazi propaganda about the Soviet Untermenschen, like, you know, many people, like including my grandparents, we're really afraid now the Soviets are coming. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And there's still like this tradition of telling the worst things you could imagine about the Soviet army being in Austria until 1955, when Austria was freed. We thought that's an interesting idea. That's why we took the small country of Unterzögersdorf and basically occupied it. We put big flags and stuff there and played a little bit with the stereotypes of the Soviet Union and blah, blah, blah. I think it was a nice theatrical performance. But we wanted to spread our ideas a little bit farther, because basically it's a project about history or the impossibility of historiography. So if you read the fake history of Soviet Unterzögersdorf, it's much more plausible than the history of Austria itself. I mean, what is history? Who writes it? Okay, and we thought, why not spreading the meme a little bit farther and making a computer game? Soviet Unterzögersdorf, PC, CD-ROM. It's for Linux, Windows, and Apple, okay? And I think let's play a little bit, okay? Okay, one more time. Whoa. And now it's switching to 320 times 200. My God. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah means no, you know? Okay. No wall. Yeah. Okay. That's still the stupid.
Oh, my God. Where is it?
It's the name of the village, and basically, if you would translate it to English, it could be translated as Lower Adobe Village or Lower Procrastination Village. It's nobody really knows. It's a dialect form of that. Okay. Let's play a little bit. It's an adventure game. We thought it's a nice idea to put the idea and the philosophical and political background of Soviet Unterzirkelsdorf into a computer game, especially an adventure game. Because, you know, nowadays only 1% of a billion dollar market computer games is adventure games. So adventure games basically are dead. It's a dead form of computer gaming. And we thought it's a nice idea to have this like retro aesthetics of adventure gaming combined with this retro leftist state communism thing called Sovietism and combine it. And now let's play a little bit. It's in Russian with English subtitles.
Дорогие товарищи из так называемых безопасных стран, моя родина, советский Унтерцёгерсдорф, простирается к юго-западу.
It's German. I'm sorry. I didn't switch it to English. I'll do that.
Да здравствует моя свободная родина, советский Унтерцёгерсдорф.
Actually, I took this picture because I'm a big fan of Carl Sagan, and that's the building where Carl Sagan taught astronomy, Ithaca University, New York, New York. Okay, so I have to go to the. I'll show you because I think you'll probably download the game. It's for free, and it has been downloaded 1.5 million times so far. So I'll show you how to switch the language. Because the standard language is German, and now what? It's in Russian actually with subtitles. To talk about Kazakh, what's Kazakh? Yes, they have a lot of potassium in Kazakhstan. Yeah. Okay, safe. And now one more time. Oh, I'm sorry.
In the meantime, crystal gazer.
Дорогие товарищи из так называемых безопасных стран, моя родина, советский Унтерцёгерсдорф, простирается к юго-западу от шоссейного узла Штокеромитте до Оберцёгерсдорфа, Зайна и Обер-Обельндорфа. Да здравствует моя свободная родина! Советский Унтерцёгерсдорф – последняя республика СССР. Наше государство не поддерживает никаких дипломатических отношений ни к так называемой Австрийской республике, ни к Европейскому сообществу. Кроме мелкой промышленности, в основном перевозки гальки и топливной энергетики, планы последних пятилеток форсировали сельское хозяйство.
I think I skip a little bit of it.
Причина наш народ советский. Мы знаем распад с недостатком природных ресурсов, недостатком населения, недостатком знаний, то есть недостатком иностранные реакционерные элементы.
You can download it at home. Glorious future, that's really important. And now, let's start.
Семь часов по советско-унтерцёгерсдорфскому времени. Секретарь партии Гамолко выходит на утреннюю смену. Всем сердцем стремится он послужить своей великой родине. Но что такое? Задний двор имени Красного Октября, на котором уже видны следы экономического упадка, замусорен выше всякой меры. Что это за беспорядок?
Этого вчера тут еще не было.
Okay, so what could we do? Well, maybe we'll have a look what's happening here. We have a door, and we have, a piece of cloth. Let's have a look.
Это остатки военной формы товарища Титова, героя родных военно-воздушных сил и космонавта. Он сгорел при входе в атмосферу. Печальная история.
Okay, let's take it. Let's take it.
Отдадим последний долг товарищу Титову этой тряпкой.
And maybe let's pick up a little bit of trash, because there's so much trash here.
Раз, два, взяли. Сейчас приберу.
Okay, and here we have the inventory. You have a passport, you have a wiping cloth now, and you have trash. Let's have a look how you actually look like. Let's have a look in your passport. And of course, he's male. Yeah, okay. Good, okay. So maybe we walk a little bit around in the Red October yard.
What? Slayer. Это что это такое? Кто это разрешил? Где дежурный?
So, something happened. A lot of trash. I mean, Slayer? What's happening, okay? So, maybe we find the answer somewhere here? Okay.
Телефонная будка номер 32. Средство мгновенной коммуникации. Чудо родной техники.
Okay. So, we can contact the Supreme Soviet. We can change the music. And we can transmit messages to the people. What do you want to do? Transmit a message. Okie dokie. The last one is actually hang up. Two? Okay.
Доверяй, но проверяй.
Okay. We probably should change the music.
Радио Свободный Советский Унтерцёгерсдорф. Передаем лучшие песни и пляски страны.
And I think we take Christianity is Stupid by Negative Land. Who actually, we contacted them and they said, fine, take it. And now it's part of Soviet Unitsukhov Radio. So. Okay. So maybe contact the Supreme Soviet. I think I'll ask him, what is a Slayer?
Объясните, пожалуйста, что такое Slayer?
Slayer. Американская группа Trash Metal, основанная в Huntington Park в Калифорнии в 1982 году. Члены группы Том Арая, бас-вокал, Керри Кинг.
That's fine, okay. I think we should hang up and go back. So there's lots of... strange trash. What's that?
О, ужас! Это компакт-диск этой сомнительной группы. Контрабанда из враждебных стран.
So, it's pro. Let's take it.
Это я и во сне себе представить не могу, иметь пластинку Пантеры.
May we go to the next? I won't show you much more, because actually you have to play it yourself. So, this is the nuclear compost area, okay? That's the 8-bit agrarian memory drive. You'll find out how it works pretty soon. I think I want to kill myself. Before that, have a look.
Радук четырехцветной печати. Metal Hammer Magazine. Важнейший печатный орган сомнительных групп. Просто ерунда какая-то. Ужас! Что за бестолковие? Фу! Фу! Ну и морды. Безвкусница!
Sometimes he says Nietzsche Club.
Ага. Вот и адрес. Ну вот, так и думал. Хулиганы из соседнего США Оберцюгерсдорф.
So, and now, let's get killed.
Кегель, помилуй нас! Что же тут случилось?
They killed all the chicken. They killed all the chicken.
Жуткие страдания. Экономически. Одна единственная курица осталась в живых. От нее зависит пропитание нашей родины. Иди сюда, курочка. Цып, 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 цып. Цып, 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 цып. Нахожусь в черноземной степи.
You know,
когда США оберцюгерсдорфовцы нагло захватили наш прекрасный надгробный холм в начале 90-х годов, нам пришлось этот район...
So.
О нет! Курица испепелена! Дурак! Что ты наделал? Это ведь была последняя курица... Опора народного хозяйства уничтожена. Теперь придется продаваться Западу с потрохами.
So, quit. So what chippy day 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 day?
Have fun, yes. Where it is? There it is.
Okay, so Sovjetunionsegostov, you can download it, you can play it. Just like a couple of words about adventure gaming in general. I think it's really interesting that adventure gaming in the 1980s and early 1990s. Was a form, like it was computer gaming or computer programming, of course, is a highly male-dominated business. But there was one woman, like in the 1980s, Sierra Online's Roberta Williams, who like basically shaped a whole industry. And just to mention, so if you think about adventure gaming, please think about Roberta Williams. So concerning women in technology businesses. Okay, good. So, let's move on and talk a little bit about a subject actually Karen asked me to talk about. I have to switch to here. It's Robexotica. Okay. Robexotica is a festival for cocktail robotics, and Monochrome is organizing it together with a group called Shifts in Vienna, Austria. And for a couple of years now, it started in 1999. Here are a couple of pictures, actually most of them by Jacob Applebaum from 2006. And you're highly invited, if you want to come to Austria, if you have an interesting cocktail robot, then please, please submit it. Okay, so I tell you why are we doing a cocktail robots festival? I mean, you know, there are many, many people, especially in the San Francisco area, who do robots who kill themselves or blow them up with like 50 feet fire, whatever. And Actually, we love robots too. And we thought, you mean like in the 1960s, if you like robotics is a basically really like anachronistic form of future. Because in the 60s, you know, modernity has invested all of its victory prey in moon rocks and everything seemed possible. And in the 60s, they all prognosted, you know, household robots in 2000, and they would toast, they would make your toast, and you would clean the floor, whatever. They had a lot of the strange ideas of the future of robotics, and it didn't work out. It worked somehow differently. Nobody talked about mobile communication and stuff like that. They talked all about robots. And we thought, why not somehow conserving or saving or re-stimulating this idea of robots that help you in a certain way, and not even help you, robots that could be in a certain way like hedonistic themselves, for example, drinking cocktails. Why not? We have a couple of cocktail robots who drink their own cocktails. So we thought we have this big, big technology bubble. We have billions of dollars invested into selling modern technology, state-of-the-art technology, and hype it, okay? And most of the stuff is dying anyways, you know, that media, yeah? And that's why I thought, why not asking for cocktail robots? Robots who can serve cocktails, mix cocktails, light cigarettes, and can have bar conversations. I mean, if you think about bar conversation, you immediately think about Turing and stuff like that. So it's actually a non-trivial thing to have a bar conversation. So basically, we have this idea of cocktail robots. Everybody gets it immediately. But like the layer beneath it is that we invite scientists, artists, cultural philosophers from all over the world to basically think about technology and what's possible and what shouldn't be possible and what might be possible. All of them somehow talking about cocktail robotics. And I mean, here's Jacob Applebaum. Maybe, Jacob, you saw all of the robots. Maybe you would comment for a couple of minutes. Because we invited him to document Robo Exotica and a couple of other things. He was our artist in residence in Vienna. Yeah.
So I'm not really prepared to talk about this, but I can say that if you have any interest in robotics or alcohol, it's definitely...
It's wrong. You have to do it like this.
Oh. But that's the right... That, yeah.
Yeah.
So if you have any interest...
God
damn it. 3 months and I still can't call myself a big Jew. It's terrible. So if you have any interest in alcohol or robotics, it's definitely the number one event I've ever attended. 2 years in a row. And I think it's I don't even think it's on. But it's definitely the best event that I've ever been to that involved alcohol and robotics. But it's not, it's not the only one. But it's safer than the other ones. You're more likely to meet interesting people there that won't try to kill you with shooting fire. Basically, the really interesting thing about going to Robo Exotica is actually getting to talk to the people that built the robots and to find out why they built the robots, and then you get to see the actual things that they're using to run the robots. Jonathan Moore and David Fine built this really cool robot, and being able to talk with the other people that come from places other than San Francisco about their robots, the different solutions they come up with are really interesting. And I mean, I'd say that it was one of the more incredible things that I've done in my life, and I think it's really great to go and see that. But I also don't remember a lot of it, which is part of the good fun. But also, Vienna is probably the most beautiful city in all of Austria. And yes, ganz in Österreich. All right. Actually, the most beautiful city in Austria. What was the concentration camp called? We didn't get to go to it. Yeah, Mauthausen. Yeah, that's the best place.
I didn't say that.
Yeah. Graz is also really fabulous, Salzburg. But Vienna is really, really fabulous because when you're not drinking all evening long looking at the robots, it's actually located, the Robo Exotica is in this place called the Freiraum, which is right next to basically 8 museums. And you, during the day, tour around, get to see all of Vienna, and then at night you'll be able to enjoy the cocktail robots and build robots, watch people hack on robots, watch the robots not work. Cal Spieltech actually built a really fabulous robot that you would blow into a microphone with a straw, and it would shoot alcohol from an octopus-ish like tentacle, and it would spray the audience. So the trick is that you would get someone to try to walk up with this. I don't know if we have, yeah, not that one. Do we have a photo of the actual? So he basically had this microphone you would blow into, and you would stand sort of off to the side, and the robotic arm would be over here, and you'd have someone walk up with the cup to get underneath the arm, because at the end of the arm was a nozzle that would sort of, depending on the pressure of the microphone that you were blowing into, it would shoot alcohol. And so the trick is that you would also be wearing this glove, and someone wouldn't see that you were wearing this glove. It's kind of like a power glove from the Super Nintendo days. And you could basically curl your arm, and it had sensors in the glove. And then the robotic arm, while someone was getting their alcohol, they basically would shoot alcohol all over everyone standing right in front of it. And that was definitely a really excellent prank to play on everyone. Because as they got drunker, they forgot, which is extremely fabulous. And Cal actually also built this really fabulous gas-powered jaw that would basically it would fry sausages that would get like basically with propane, and he would have little kids cooking sausages, and then their parents would walk up, and then he would close the jaw when their hands were near it, and there's this giant metal jaw just clamping shut, and the parents would scream about their children's hands. So it's if you have a chance to come,
you like it.
Yeah, you should come and see it. Hey, I've been saying if I'm going to eat meat again, it's time eating children.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Woo. Okay. So we have the actual exhibition with all the different robots and installations, and we have the conference. And the topic of the last conference was basically cybernetics and why cybernetics crushed and failed in the beginning of the 1970s. Why cybernetics ate its own tail. And the topic of the conference before 2 years ago was beautiful failure. And you see, I mean, beautiful failure is like what you could call it. In certain robots never actually worked at all. But that's fine. It's good that the humans who build it work to talk about what it should do or what not to do or whatever. We had a couple of, as Jake mentioned already, we had a couple of robots this year or last year that actually could kill you. Like the Ice Cube murderer. We thought, yeah, why not like having robots that could crush ice? And there was one, a young lady from Vienna who like basically mounted a big mechanical ice pick on a comfy chair. And if you put ice there, it would fuck. And it would go. It would basically go through a telephone book. More screaming parents. Yeah. Okay. So if you're interested, I mean, it's an interesting concept you might have heard about. It's called state funding. we actually get money from the Austrian government to do stuff like that. Not a lot, but we get. Yeah. It's semi very pinkish socialism. Yes, yeah. But compared to your, yeah, okay. Lieberman. Yes. Okay. Okay. And so, if you have good like ideas, if you have whatever you want to, maybe you want to talk at the next conference, maybe you want to come to Vienna to show a robot, whatever. Or build robot there, yeah? So please send us an email. We get money, and we try somehow to sort out to get all of the people who want over to Vienna. Sometimes it works that we just can pay like half of the plane tickets or a third of it, whatever. But we try our best to get you over. So please, please think about it. And, you know, actually, it's something really special. Wired wrote about it. Yeah. Ooh. And Boeing, Boeing. And Slash dot.
Okay. Stop.
Okay. And Laughing Squid. What? Pardon? Pardon? I was blogging for... I like it. It's a really great blog. As many, many millions of other people think. Okay. Good. So, I think we see a little bit of Robic Sotica in practice after my talk. Standing here, the external combustion engine. Actually, it's not really working, is it?
There's no gas.
There's no gas. You have like, yeah, you have gas here? Okay. Ah, it's President's Day. No nitrogen on President's Day. First, they put Jefferson and Washington together to form President's Day, and then they don't sell nitrogen. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, I get it. I get it. Freedom. Okay, good. Okay, so, and that's basically... maybe a good idea to talk about Zambia. Because when I'm talking about the United States of America and the Constitutional of Canada, I think about Zambia. Why? Because we would like to infect you. We have 80 copies of the immigration papers. Okay? They look like that. Okay? It basically says... Nation of Zambia. So, okay, Jake, come. Let's try it. Okay, come here. Okay. I mean, I know there is a lot of like zombie thingies here, and people like dress up as zombies and walk and go to the Apple Store and actually do not destroy it. Just go there. Okay.
Genius brains.
Okay. So this is actually. That's a little bit more like subliminal, okay? So, you're an American. Actually, only American, as like US of A's, and Canadians can be official citizens of Zambia. No illegal aliens, you know, and stuff. If you have a passport, a driver's license, something like that, you can. Okay, I know you're from San Francisco, so I would hand you this copy, Nation of Zambia. There are all the rules written on it. What you can do, you basically take this one, copy it, and infect other people, and the people will have to go to a certain homepage. What's... No. So, to a certain homepage. The Zambia homepage. And they can go to the epidemic map here and mark where they have been infected, okay? So, we have a look here. In the last week, there was one infection. John P. Reynolds from probably San Francisco, okay? We're going to have a look. So far, we have infected all zombies. Not last week, last year. There they are. Okay, we have... A little bit of spreading here. But actually, there's like not so many here. There are a lot of in Toronto and New York. And so, but I think there got to be more citizens of Zambia here. And you are a zombie now. Okay? And now, what zombie or not to be? This is no question, yes? Yeah. Yes, infect your lawyer. Okay. I mean, you're actually not allowed to infect people that are under 18 years old, yeah? But actually, we are not enforcing it, you know, just do it. What? It's none of our business, okay? Copy the certification, infect more people. There is no turning back. I mean, if you like, and if you're not into infecting people, you can be a sleeper cell and wait a couple of months and then infect people. Famous last words? Actually, we like on the rules. There's actually written don't enter your name and don't enter last words because zombies don't do that. But all the people write last words. Of course. I don't know. Ah! Branko. Branko is from Niagara Falls. Whatever. I don't know. So after my talk, you get all infected if you want to. And then you go to the page and, you know, Google map it. And okay, fine. So basically, there would be one question. Do you want to hear about another project? We would love to invite you to help us. Or should I finish and sing a song for you? Finish? Project! Okay. Song. Ah! You know, I think it's democracy. Okay, good. The other project. Sing. Okay, I can. I try, okay? I try. Okay. It is called the Representer, okay? And it's the Representer. Why? And actually, why are we talking? Because we need specialists in the field of semantic web. Is there anybody here who knows something about semantic web? What? What? I don't. I'm lacking this special vocabulary. What's tantic? Whatever. Okay. Good. Okay. So I'm making a fool of myself. Okay. The Representer. The basic. Should I really sing it? Okay. 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 The overhead projector song. Download it. Come on. It's all free on the net. Nah, I'll sing a different song for you. A different song afterwards. The Representer basically is an idea we are now breeding for like a year or something like that. And we still have problems with it. So maybe we need some like people who are like into semantic web and technology and basically like data banks and I don't know. Okay, the basic idea is human beings have spent the better part of their development history in the steppe, yeah? So the era that brought us skills in counting and writing and building and generating knowledge and building Tesla coils and whatever began not all that long ago. Now we construct aircraft carriers, an object like the Sears Tower. We visit like trenches that are like 10,000 meters in depth. We build radio telescopes and, by the way, the energy of a feather falling to the ground is more energy than all the energy, all the radio telescopes all over the planet ever got from outer space. Ooh. Okay. So we are confronted with really big scales and really small scales, and still we have a savanna brain. And I think we have a problem with that. And we are forced to deal with dimensions that are far beyond those of bushes, stones, day, night, and approaching wildcats, okay? So that's why we want to have the Representer, because we need comparisons and we need representations. That means the Representer should be a universal converter. It is intended to help people visualize various orders of magnitude, regardless of whether they derived from the astronomical or the microscopic or everyday life. I tell you a short story, maybe. Okay, that's good. Okay, a thing that the Representer should actually be able to do is, basically I think it's a big data bank with objects defined that could like refer to Wikipedia or whatever, I don't know. For example, you enter your weight as a point of departure. And now you have numerous possibilities for making calculations with this dimension. You decide to find out what the value in euros of your weight in gold would be. Okay? Now you have a And this euro value represents a new dimension with which you can continue to calculate. And the next, you have you could compute how many loaves of bread you would be able to buy with the amount of gold that you are like that's your body weight. In the next step, you could you would like to know how much of the distance of between Earth and Moon it would be to put the bread loaves next to each other. And after that, and how much time does, for example, it take for a projectile moving from a gun, for example, to fly this distance alongside the bread. And then you could actually try to find out how many clock cycles in a 1 gigahertz processor, for example, can compute in that amount of time as like the bullet is flying. And then you could like find out how many Beethoven's fifth symphonies by counting each of these clock cycles measure as music and blah blah blah, whatever. And you could go forever. And the basic idea is to have a data bank where people enter objects, and then those objects should be possible to compare them together and form an infinite line of comparisons and comparisons and comparisons and representations. Yeah, and I still think it's an interesting idea. I don't know. If you're not think, then maybe not. But I think it would be an interesting idea to build it with RDF files, for example, to like basically connect it to everyday like data, for example, where Jupiter at the moment is, what the gold cores at the what the gold exchange rate is, for example, at this very moment. Whatever. I mean, if you find that interesting, we couldn't find anybody so far. I try. Then maybe I'm not sure. It's all. We had a couple of problems with the conversion stuff and whatever. So I think if you're interested, contact us. Evelyn is over there. and now the last thing in my presentation. And actually, we are big collectors. We love to collect stuff. That's why we blog, for example, and stuff. And we love to collect what's called corporate anthems. Okay? And I'd like to play for you and sing with you the corporate anthem of Fujitsu. Okay? Fujitsu. Fujitsu is a wonderful corporation. They had like the birthday of Fujitsu was the 12th of June. And they sent out PowerPoints to all the Fujitsu outlets all over the world on the 12th of June to sing together the Fujitsu song. And then the Germans bought them and now they're not singing. good. But we are here and we can sing. Get your lighters, get your sparklers, get your Tesla coils, and cell phones probably. I'm currently reading this new novel by Stephen King where all the people who have cell phones turn into crazies. Really good book, actually. The first book of Stephen King I actually ever read. It's true. Good, okay. Fortsetzen. Good. Where is it? It doesn't work. I have to get out of it. What's that?
Evelyn, come here. I tried to find the song. There it is.
Let's run out now to greener fields where shines a splendid sun. We have a dream, a wondrous dream. let's join our hands with everyone and smile at each new hour. We have a dream, an endless dream of youthful love and power. We want to use all our skill now, all our strengths unfurled. We plan uniting all our new techniques over the world. Our Fujitsu, gorgeous links all over the heart throughout the human race. An unseen power now in our grasp can even conquer space. We want to find a new harmony both in work and play. We'll share the fresh things we discover now, build joy with every new day.
I saw people in the audience. Fujitsu, damn you. I would say, I mean, just like maybe one final statement concerning, you know, Fujitsu was bought by the Germans and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, it's really hard. I mean, you get up in the morning, you're working for Fujitsu, and you're going and you brush your teeth and you go to the toilet, and then you think, come on, I have to build a new day. What a fucking metaphor is that? Okay, please, you know, you're in the town of body modifications. Tattoo it on your brain, please. Okay, building a new day. Thanks a lot. And now, I think it's your turn.
All right, thanks, Monochrome. Thanks, Johannes and Evelyn. So we're going to do an open talk now. Some of you have already spoken to me and said you wanted to talk, so why don't you all come up here? Some of you need to set up first. Are you actually ready to go? Okay, do we have... who was the first one who wanted to talk? It was one of our hosts here. Is that you coming up? Okay, host get the first right, and then Jonathan and the rest of you, get ready. So who wants to open dog? Jonathan, Raj? I wrote this down very carefully, but then I left a piece of paper somewhere else. We can sing the Fujitsu song while we're waiting. Except that it's not up anymore. You can just hum along, okay?
Okay, this is a little gravity simulator, basically an N-body simulator. Ooh, I've got to put the music on. All right. So it's a generative music algorithm, and what's going on is that all of the bodies have mass and position and velocity, and the rocks, which are square, have mass and position. They don't move. And I just run the gravity equations and let them move around. And you can sort of see them interacting with each other. And when they collide, they've got notes and melodies attached to them. So when they collide, they light up. When they collide and play a note, they light up a little more. And the universe has a semi-permeable membrane. Every so often, things get trapped outside until friction slows them down, and they kind of get pulled back in. So you get to build little worlds with it. I'll switch to the next one. So this one starts off with a little spiral, and then nothing starts off with a velocity, and they just sort of attract each other and go. Only a few things have melodies attached to them, so that it's a little bit sparser when it actually plays stuff. Somewhere in there, there's a duck. So I had this running during intermission, but you probably couldn't hear it because we were all talking loudly. Then when it's time to go to the next one, all the stars wink out one by one. This one's kind of fun. They start off in orbit and then slowly move away from each other. Actually, I've spent a lot of time composing for randomness and composing and making systems that will run melodies or harmonies against each other randomly. So that experience helped a lot here. Every time you run these, this is a simulator, so it's deterministic. Number two.
Is that better?
Okay. So it's a simulation. So every time you run it, it's exactly the same. So you can sort of do a little work with setting up the initial melodies, but after it goes for a while, you just don't know. This one's really interesting. I was working with my friend Limbo to try and get something that would play a great big chord. So we set up a bunch of balls so they would hit the rocks all at once. But it turns out that they just go and go and never hit until eventually the rounding errors kick in and, you know, they've gotten attracted by enough of one, so they'll hit one every so often. And then the organs kick in. It was kind of consternating to do that because we were trying to get a big chord at first and we couldn't get it to do anything. This one's fun. So you start with eight balls that are going around a central one, and they're perfectly symmetric and all going at the same speed, so it attracts the central ball the same amount, so it stays in the same place. And it'll just keep going. The edge rules? When it gets outside the universe, it reflects itself off the normal vector of the edge of the universe. So you saw it was basically symmetrical for a while until the rounding errors kicked in, and then it moves a little bit. After that, it's complete chaos, and there's no way to predict what's going on. I really like it when balls start to twin around each other. So it's not just... It's the right town for it. So it's... I'll play a couple more for you. So after everything started running the same every time, it got a little boring, so I put in mutators. These ones that... you can see the square inside. Every time something hits it, it changes mass or velocity.
And also the little ball in there is a mutator, so it'll change whatever it hits. You see, they light up a little bit more and they change size when something hits them. So after this, it starts being more random and doesn't come out the same every time. I experimented with a couple of geometric ones. I'll show you a couple more worlds, and then I'll turn it over to the next open dorker. So here the rocks are in a pyramid. There's a note attached to each of the squares. It's basically a series of scales going up at different octaves. Now, if you run the same one with three balls instead of one, it comes out different. Now, the center one got stuck outside the universe. And they're completely symmetric for a while until the rounding errors get them. Doubles. This is all written in Java. It's MIDI, so it's all well-tempered Western scale. What? I could, but I just used the Java MIDI API to generate sound. So it's just using the default instruments that come with it. All right, do one more. This is the grid one. So there's a melody on each of the squares. So this is called Kepler's Orrery, after Kepler, who was trying to find the music of the spheres. And I'll let the next person open dork.
Very cool.
Thanks, Simran.
Whoa,
that's loud. Sorry about that. Thanks, Simran. Jonathan, you want to go next? And let's see. We have Christopher Palmer. We have Raj. And was there another one? Okay, Jonathan.
Hello. I realize now that most of you won't be able to see this, but this is the machine that I made and brought to Vienna for Robo Exotica. I made it with my partner, David Fine, who is hiding somewhere in the back. He ran away when zombies were mentioned. Oh, there he is. All right. The point of this robot is that... There's a story to it, but I can't actually hold it up because it's like two or three pieces, and it requires gravity to stay together. The basic concept for this is that it's somewhat like an engine. If you see these tanks back here, which normally hold your alcohol and mixers, are sort of meant to look a little bit like a V-block engine. And then we have here the dispensing device and reading device, where we actually use, I believe these are GM fuel injectors, so electronic fuel injectors, which are really just valves with like an atomizer on the front. And normally if it wasn't President's Day, you could attach this hose to a tank of nitrogen, which pressurizes the bottles, which is used to pump the liquids at pressure, so not to enough pressure to go through the fuel injectors. And then there are no buttons on it or anything like that. Instead of buttons, we use RFID. So we have a bunch of these RFID cards. And in the box, there is an RFID card reader and a basic stamp microcontroller that reads the tag on the card and then can prepare different mixes based on which card it reads to our desire. When I was, this is actually slightly improved since Rotobo Exotica, despite the fact that it's not running. The software is I fixed a few things that were leaking, hopefully. And at Robo Exotica, we actually only had the test software on it because we pretty much did all the fabrication the night before I left. So it didn't. I didn't actually expect it to work at all, and actually it worked better than pretty much any other robot. So that's either tells you something about Robo Exotica or luck or I don't know what. So it was. It made drinks much faster than the bar. Though I served a lot more drinks than the bar did at Robo Exotica, and the drink it actually happened to make was equal parts vodka, dark rum, and a dark berry juice, which very nicely looked like gasoline. And so that drink is guaranteed to be made by it at all times because it should make something that looks like gasoline. So that's the basic concept. We're going to replace these square cards with round ones in the future and embed them in the bottom of glasses. So all you have to do is put your glass down, and it'll make a drink. And what glass you put down will depend on the drink. And that's the basic concept. If anybody's any questions about it, be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll sit down. Mr. Applebaum.
Could you talk about your problem with interference that would cause it to make random drinks?
Oh, well, okay. Well, that's now resolved. Well, but no, I fixed that exploit. Because see, initially, since it just had test code, the test code just said anytime you read any valid RFID tag, just start up the program and then make the one thing it does. But since if that's any valid encoded signal, a random noise would occasionally cause it to fire because it would match some number. That doesn't happen anymore because now it actually reads the cards. Actually, if I plug it in, I can make it makes a pretty sound. So I'll plug it in. Sorry. But yeah, so it's not remotely exploitable anymore. It's particularly exploitable because I guess the tags, actually, David just told me today, are in the 2.5 gigahertz. So it makes more random drinks, like when people are using Wi-Fi and whatnot. And that's that junk band anyway, and you've got microwaves in it, and these are not reaching. This is really not very helpful. Could you use passwords? I don't think they use the same. I don't think they're in the 2.5 gigahertz band. I mean, that's such a junky band. But so it takes these cards. They're from Parallax sells this thing. It's the cheapest RFID unit you can buy, which is why we used it, because, we don't have much money. And I'm sorry.
There's a plug back here if you want.
Yeah, it's just tangled up. That's the problem. So I can't. If I put this down, it'll. Oh, there, now it reaches the ground. Okay.
I'm surprised that you thought that was a bug that needed to be fixed. It sounded to me like a feature.
Well, it's a feature except when there's no glass sitting there and it just squirts a drink onto the machine with nothing underneath.
Anybody see a problem with that? There you go, solution. With no software.
I don't think I actually need that one anyway. Let's see, is that one? Oh, there we go. So.
Can you turn up the mic and see if I can pick that up?
Anyway, I don't know if you could hear that, but that's the noise it makes. It makes a nice clicky noise, which is fun. And although it's static, when it's running, it's pretty cool because you get the jets are in that same pattern turn on and off, and actually it gives the whole thing a lot of motion. If we really wanted, actually, I could show a video. We could bring up the GETV video later or something like that, and you could see the video that was recorded at Robo Exotica of it. Sing a song. Efficient. What made it efficient?
Efficient means people had to wait between 3 and 5 minutes to get a drink at our coffee.
Okay. So we had high throughput.
How many cocktails did you serve?
Well, I was serving shots, given that it was mostly hard liquor, and I think I went through opening night. I think I had to refill all those bottles 2 or 3 times. So I think I made 4 or 6 liters opening night. So I don't know. That's Yeah, something like that. That's a lot of shots, you know. So shots. Anybody else have questions?
How did you transport it?
I put it in a suitcase with a nice note that said, please don't pull me off of the airplane. And since I checked it, you know, and they only x-ray some of the bags, they didn't, I'm pretty sure they didn't see it because they didn't open it. And like I was telling everybody on, when I was coming over, like, you know, that we stayed with Johannes and saying that, you know, this really looked like, after I packed it, because I packed it up with my clothes, and it really looks like there's a bomb in my suitcase. And everybody's like, yeah, you know, everybody cares if the robots worries about that. And I opened it up and people looked at it and said, yeah, that really looks like a bomb. Because, you know, so, I mean, it was taken apart, and you have this big black thing and these 4 metal canisters and wires and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah, you've got the 4 metal canisters and wire. It's a mess. Yeah, no, I mean, it's true. I mean, and yeah, they don't, you know, if it doesn't look like something they've been told to look at, they don't know what it is anyway, you know. I don't think they actually stamped my passport on the way out. I think they, I'm not even sure they did. I don't. Oh, okay, yeah. But anyway.
On ink.
Any other questions?
Can you leave that up so we can take a look at it after?
Absolutely. All right. Thanks.
Okay, why don't we have Raj, why don't you come and plug in? Do you have something to say, or did you have something to?
Great, perfect. Just segueing from Jonathan's suspected bomb device here, I wanted to bring up a couple suspected terrorists who found some terrorist hoax devices here in San Francisco. 3 of them, actually. We've got Michelle here, and Sapphire. Yeah, turn them on, hold them up. People want to see them. Magic Sapphire and Jonathan Joff over here. Fully functional. Explosive devices. Here, how about you guys get together and get out of the way. Photo shoot. Can you get them to work? Yours is not really on. There you go. I'm going to bid on eBay for one of these. Great idea. Yeah, let's get the story. Michelle, why don't you say? You know, right?
Let's start with Sapphire.
Okay.
Has the first one in San
Francisco. So Sapphire, you found the first one, is that right?
Yeah. Basically, I was looking on Flickr one night, and I saw this really cool electrograph, this thing right here. And I looked at all the different locations where they had them, and there's one picture for San Francisco, and I basically blew up the photo, put it through Photoshop, sharpened it, and I saw that there was a Western Union sign, so I went to the Western Union website, and I looked at all the different locations, and there are actually Chinese characters on the sign, so I figured that was probably on Clement Street or on Irving Street or in Chinatown. And I cross-referenced all the Chinese locations with the Western Unions, and it was right where I thought it would be, on 7th and Clement.
Right on. By the way, did you find these before the Boston Scare or after? Before, really? Wow, so you're old school.
On the spine of a lighted sign, and it was attached with these rare earth magnets on the back, and so it's really tough to get off. We actually had to beat it down with a stick.
They're neodymium magnets.
Neodymium magnets?
Yeah. They're pretty burly. Found that out firsthand.
Cool. How did you find yours?
I actually saw mine in the Outer Hate, and it was up on a lamppost, and it had a little bit of climbing with like a garbage can and a little bit of shimmying up a lamppost, but like, I was able to pull it down, but it kind of fell, and I broke the battery clip, but it was worth it. It was a worthy endeavor.
Do you need any help from some geeks here to fix it, or are you good?
I'm okay. Actually, if someone knows where to source this apparently very strange and rare 4D cell battery clip, I'd be you know, I'd be very thankful. I've scoured Mauser and Fairchild and like DigiKey all on their online sites and in their catalogs. I can't find it anywhere. So if you know where to get these battery clips, I'd be totally jazzed to hear about it. Yeah? Yeah, the thing is like there are already some holes tapped in the board, so I wanted to just like match it up so I didn't have to like mess with it. But
you want to keep it authentic too anyway, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'll figure it out. I haven't really done much.
Why don't you leave them in their natural habitat?
I wanted to put it somewhere.
That's not a swear word.
I wanted to actually like replace it somewhere that would be really hard to get down so it would stay, and maybe add like a solar panel so I could charge some batteries. I'm open to suggestions and collaboration if anyone's got any good ideas and wants to do a little climbing.
Actually, I think, Michelle, you have an idea about getting a few of these together, maybe doing a little flash mob to the Golden Gate Bridge or something, right?
Well, let's start with after Sapphire got hers, and she called me up, and it was 2 blocks away from my house. And so, of course, I had to get one because it was just so awesome. And my friend, as we were going to a concert, I just randomly saw it on a signpost up above at Divisadero and Hayes. So I run into the store, and I bore the shopkeeper with my story of, there's this cartoon figure, and there's 400 across America. Really, there are. And then he let me borrow his mop, which was very kind of him. And then after many hits and whacks and persistence, it fell down, and my friend caught it. But anyways... But now that we have 3 of us together, and there's of course many more in San Francisco, we want to get all the people who have these together and throw a party.
Right, Aqua Teen Hunger Force party.
We believe so.
We have maybe a pretty good lead on one, but I don't know.
Why not make more?
He's got dibs on it.
Bootlegs.
Were they all made by the same artist? Do we know those 2 guys that got that busted in? No. Yeah, exactly.
If anybody has any leads on who has these, please. Or who is interested in coming to said party, please come to chasingcacti.com and leave a comment so that we can find you. Or leave a comment with laughingsquid.com and he'll tell us.
Yeah, have you had any problem with the authorities of the FBI or the anybody come to your door and said, hey, why are you harboring terrorist devices?
Well, I think the main thing is that nobody even cared when it's like up there just like hitting away with a mop for like 10 minutes. So it was like 7 p.m. and there we were just whacking away. And
wow, we're so apathetic in the city.
Yeah.
All right. What was the question? Have they talked to the coordinator?
The creator.
Or creator. Yeah, any of you?
I tried contacting the PR guy behind this, the guy who actually, the marketing department guy, and he hasn't returned my email, so, yeah.
I don't think he works for Warner Brothers anymore.
Actually, I heard that the president of Cartoon Networks resigned because of this, yeah.
All right, I guess that's it. Yeah, all right.
Anyone know how much those are selling for online?
Thousands of dollars. Thousands of dollars on eBay, last I checked. And if you want to read about the full story, check out my blog, magicsapphire.vox.com. Magicsapphire.com is also accessible. It's spelled with 1 F.
Who are your bodyguards?
You are.
All right. I'll buck up. All right, one more. Share alike, can they copy?
Sure. Take a look.
Yeah, for sure.
Were those professionally fabricated, or did someone make them by hand?
They appear to be like, well, a little bit of both. I haven't really figured out what the board is. I mean, it's not like fiberglass PCB. It's not like a, like FR4 or anything like that. Like it feels like a plastic board, but there's definitely pretty nice traces on the bottom, and you can have a look if you want. It looks kind of like a prosumer, kind of like professional hobbyist or something. I mean, it's pretty. It's not a botched job, but it's not like mass produced or whatever. Yeah, it's pretty easy to put it together, so it's kind of hard to say. Like, I mean, have a look.
There's a little pick there's a microchip pick processor.
Yeah, I started poking around with it, and I'm not sure if maybe the fuses were set or something, but I had some trouble getting the code off. But yeah, there's a little pick down here, and it's pretty straightforward, actually. Yeah, there's just like a little regulator and like a boost converter and just a little pick. Couple of discrete components. But
where do the explosives attach?
I haven't really figured out how to do that. I guess when we got the sign done. But yeah. I suppose you could put hide them down here. Yeah.
If that had been a terror device, would people have been hurt?
only their feelings would be hurt.
Yeah. I don't know.
Have a look.
Yeah, I hope you all can see this, because I'm doing it as hard as I can.
You should turn up the volume.
Yeah.
All right. So can people come up and check these out if they want to? No? All right, cool.
All right, let's see. We've got... let me let Chris Palmer speak quickly. You ready to go there? Okay, Chris, you have an announcement? And then we've got one more open door, and then I'll be back.
Cool. God, I can't believe I'm following Ignignacht and up here. Hey, some of you already know me. I'm CTP. I teach, I build shit, I blow shit up. Anyway, my class at San Francisco Art Institute is called, what the hell is it called? Oh, Intro to Activating Objects. Microcontrollers in art and such, and what I'm looking for is guest lecturers. I had a bunch of folks from Dorkbot, SF Microcontrollers, a bunch of other places come in and guest lecture for me, and I'm looking for that again. I have no money for you, so it's just a favor thing, kindness of your heart, but the students love it, so if you'd like to come in and influence the next generation of dorks, get in touch with me, please, because I'd love to have people bring stuff in. CTP@ctpdesign.com.
What kind of presentations are you looking for?
Just about anything inspiring. It can be stuff. What I'm teaching them is microcontrollers, basic actuators, basic sensors. But really, the sky's the limit. It doesn't have to be something that they could build in the class. Just something that just will inspire them. These are all college BFN, MFA students, so 20s. So any other questions on that? Just get in touch. Love to have anybody bring stuff to show. Thanks.
Thank you, Christopher. Okay. Last one here is Raj, who has a quick demonstration for us.
Hi. This is a quick demonstration on how to use graffiti to fight spam. Waiting for the projector. There we go. All right. So we're using graffiti to fight spam. If you've been to PayPal or Yahoo or been to a blog, you've seen these things called CAPTCHAs. They're automated Turing tests, supposedly, to tell computers and humans apart. And this is like a standard one from the secure image plugin of WordPress. You can see some obfuscated text, and to prove that you're a human and not a spam bot, you type in what the letters are, and it lets you post a comment or create an account or whatever. So what's the problem with this? Well, if you're a big site like PayPal or Yahoo, it turns out that things like this are extremely easy to break. So the fact is that these are just too easy. The computer vision people, the pattern recognition people can break these above 90% of the time. The current ones used by PayPal can be broken like 98% of the time. So they're not real true Turing tests. So what's the other problem? The other problem is that they're too hard. So if you run like a small WordPress blog like we do, it turns out like when I was trying to leave a comment on my own blog, like I couldn't log in like a third of the time. And plus it's ugly. So what's our solution? Well, we use captures that look like this and like that, like this. So also hard for computers to figure out what they say, but very easy for humans to do so. Based on our logs, it turns out that there are no computers that are using OCR attacks on these or sophisticated image processing attacks on these. They're very, very simple, so it doesn't take a lot. If you're running a big site, the cool thing is that if you move away from one standard algorithm, it makes it much, much harder to break. So using really pretty images that you make or your friends make. this is the first one I used. It turns out that the Abby OCR engine can break this very, very fast. So this is close to impossible. This is very easy. So anyway, if you run a WordPress blog, you get the free open source plugin right there. And it's really trivial code, so you can implement it yourself if you have run some other blog. Questions?
How many events do you have, and how do you prevent against dictionary attacks if you can't randomly generate them?
Right. So, we ship with 16. This is the blog. Like you can see, this is the blog post. These are the default images. They're all Creative Commons. And we try to attribute the photographer and the artist. And when you want to leave a comment, you can see this is the CAPTCHA. And you type it in there, and it shows you like the photo of who took it and the artist if we know it, and like a link to the original Flickr page. How do you avoid a dictionary attack? There's a few ways. One way is you can append some random data to the end of the image, which makes the JPEG or the ping decoder just ignore it. Another way is you could run this through an image processing toolkit to like scramble the image a little bit. But the best way, at least if you run a small site, is to use your own images. And it basically makes it not economically viable to like break one small blog at a time because they have unique images. And getting away from the monoculture of a single algorithm generating millions of captures a day makes it not economically viable for a spammer to attack. Kind of, but we're a lot prettier. I don't know what this is.
Great project. That's crazy.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Raj. Okay, that brings us to the end of another wonderful DorkBot. Thanks, Karen, for organizing it. Thanks, Encounter Studios, for having us. Thanks, Virginia the Tamale Lady, Pete the Bartender. Who else? Thank you all for coming. What? Go drink more beer, and if there's no beer left, just put your money in the donation box, and we look forward to seeing you all again at the next DorkBot. Good night. Thank you.